He says, well, I agree that there is less perversion in a relationship where there is more love. That is my private belief. I could not prove it, and no one else has. Yet if one is to state such beliefs publicly, one has to be convincing. The issues are too important. Before we reduce freedom of speech or the rights of consenting adults to privacy, including privacy to engage in aberrant sexual behavior, the argument must be a match for the risks we are asked to run. Here is what I need in order to be convinced. Some demonstration that the mass of mankind is inherently good and that its capacity for love rather than hatred can be harnessed now, not in some unstated future. A worthy description of what is meant by love between two people so that I can judge whether it is worth more to our society right now in these dangerous times than the freedom of press and speech and the right to private perversion we are asked to limit. A reasonable demonstration that this love is available now by some route that can be revealed to most people so that this means of saving society can be instituted. Some demonstration that if perversion and hostility will not go away, punitive laws will either dissipate these conditions or drive them underground without their still being dangerous. Guidelines on how we should call up the forces of repression and then soften them before these forces, and especially the people who will take the power of repression into their own hands, go further than the sorcerer's apprentices would want. I am uneasy with the idea that the prime solution to the problem of corruption is that man's inherent capacity to love will see us through, but that till we can tap that love, we should take away some of his freedom. The main question then, has to do is that if you make these things illegal, in other words, if you outlaw bad, will good spring up automatically?
No.
Obviously not. The two don't have that connection with one another. And so do we want to throw out the baby with the bathwater in this regard?
But I'm glad you read that. He's not quite so clear in his own mind either.
Well, no. Because as I said the other day, you can rank the degrees of hostility involved in various kinds of sexual fantasies.
But when he speaks of prohibiting private, he's always referring to like pornography and so on as private consenting adults and so on. But how do you keep it private? I mean, if what someone does in privacy gives ideas that's going to end up being harmful to someone that isn't a consent.
Okay, well, which that'd be a good example of which ideology?
Which ideology?
That I've gone over so far. Your argument just now.
Jehovah's. First one, yeah.
It's a really clear example of a Jehovahist argument.
Right.
And and that's where that goes, towards censorship and repression of private behavior too.
I still can't agree with the fact that if we can't get rid of all evil, then we don't try to do any. We don't try to get rid of portions of it because good won't spring up from it. So I mean, that's ridiculous to me. Then, I mean, I don't have as much emotion or passion about other issues as I do about pornography.
But the other thing is that it's not just censorship that you have to realize that in history, sexual repression also goes right along with the repression of women. And the two are always in tandem with one another. But whenever the severe times of sexual repression take place, it's the woman who suffers in her own liberation and her own freedom the most.
And the
periods of sexual liberation are exactly the opposite.
Pornography is still repressing women, and pornography is very much a man's business.
No.
You're
talking about one kind of pornography.
The dominant.
And you're not talking about the kind of pornography that women use for sexual excitement.
Name it.
Do you see that wrong?
Well, most epic novel, a lot of epic novels.
Epic novels, yeah.
Romantic, mostly, romantic contexts.
Where's that hostility in that?
That's probably suppressive of women, too.
It's
so
wise.
The idea that there.
Well, you ask a question that's easily answerable.
Yeah, what?
Where the hostility is in that.
Where?
Well, that's, I don't want to, if you want to talk to me about that, I can, it's going to vary, one piece of pornography may mean different things to different persons. But the fact is, I think take this fantasy, which you see on the front of a lot of books. It's what are called bodice ripper novels. You know, which shows a woman with breasts, you know, and low cut and some ripped gown, you know, and some guy's holding her and sweet, you know, like in Gone with the Wind kind of thing, and kissing her and stuff like that. Well, it's not men that read those books, it's women that read those books, right? Now the interpretation of hostility there, of course, is that it's the woman's fantasy. And in any fantasy, the person fantasizing is in control. In other words, making that happen. And so that the man in that context is objectified and is an extension of the woman's fantasy. And it's not rape in that sense. A person obviously can't choose to be raped. That's a contradiction in terms.
Isn't the fantasy that, I mean, I see more women's fantasy on a romantic level.
Sure.
Being embraced and nurtured and loved and cared for and not...
And that, the reason that's not outlawed is because men don't think of that as pornography.
Well, I can't see that that's obscenity or pornography. I can't understand how you come to that label that as pornography.
Well, how would you guess I would?
I don't know.
I would have to define pornography to encompass that. As any material, written, visual, sound, you know, that's used to as a vehicle for sexual excitement.
But then how does that come under the term of perversion?
Yeah.
Because there's an element of hostility that's involved and control.
So then anything comes under the term of perversion?
Sure.
Anything
yes.
to do with sex?
Yes. From this author's perspective.
Uh-huh.
No, not everything that has to do with sex. Everything that has to do with sexual excitement. And hostility isn't the only thing that increases sexual excitement. The other two things that he's discovered are risk. And the risk can be either actual risk or, you know, the risk of being caught, or the risk, you know, those kinds of risks. Or it can be a fantasized risk. And in many cases, it's a fantasized risk. For example, the one I just gave, the bodice ripper example, is a fantasized risk. And the third element that's important is mystery, the tension between what's known and what isn't known. That's why, you know, sexy bathing suits tend to be a lot more erotic than acres of nude people on a beach. And why, you know, nudity is so easily transformed in one's mind to be sort of a natural, rather non-erotic thing.
Can you repeat those three?
Risk. Well, the major one is hostility, then risk, and then mystery. So the theory is that those are the three elements that are involved in a sexual fantasy. And that the fantasy is, as I said the other day, is a joyful or a pleasurable plot or story or fantasy that turns old pains or problems into pleasurable outcomes. So it solves that dilemma, the releasing tension from past gender problems.
George, I still don't see that with what you define as female pornography, that should be liberating in any way for women, because I think it's still a bad idea that it expresses.
Well, maybe it allows the woman to stay in that relationship with that ugly man that she can't stand.
That is not liberating.
Yeah.
Who said it was?
You did.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, you said that there was female.
Yeah, it releases. It takes care of
that
pain.
That pornography was liberating compared to former times when it was repressed.
No, I didn't say that pornography was. I said that sexual liberation is. What did you hear me say again? Say that again.
I was arguing against pornography because I found it suppressive of women because women always made objects in it.
Well, unless
and
it's the women's
it
fantasies.
As an object for male.
That's
women.
So true. In female fantasies, the man has to be an object. Has to be the object.
Not in the same.
Because
I don't see
they can't
it.
Be
he's
the
got
subject.
Personality. He's got.
They can't be the subject.
A relationship with someone other than just
but he's not real.
Sex act?
He's
well,
not
either
real.
Is a woman in that. No.
And wouldn't it be nice if all males were that way? I don't understand that you can't see this point. That when somebody makes a fantasy up, it's like somebody writes down a novel. You know, it's to be extended out that way, but it could be also very simple too.
But why is that a women's fantasy then? I mean, every piece of literature then is a fantasy. Everything written is a fantasy because it comes out of
someone's mind. Well, no, there's nonfiction and fiction. All pornography comes out of someone's mind. Yes, it wasn't given from on high.
Why,
you know, like manna from heaven.
There might be an evil force behind
you. Somebody, you know, there's people that whose job it is to write that stuff up, and they give them a list of plots or a list of words or a list of things to just incorporate ideas in it because they think that it sells or will sell.
And so soap operas, I look at soap operas and all I see is hostility. I turn them off, you know, and women just,
well,
men now
men,
too,
men,
that's
women.
A friend of mine who's a counselor, a school counselor, said that she thinks that girls and boys, especially, and girls, she found this, that girls started talking so aggressive about who or how do men learn about sexuality then, and how could that... confusion between epideictic and epigamic behaviors be understood and be separated. In her article, Beatrice Faust says that when the Western Christianity repressed both aggression or violence and sexuality. And so when the two are closely, have close association within the brain, the aggressive and sexual responses in the brain are just very close to one another. And they probably are activated similarly by some of the same influences. The pure male sexual behavior has elements that are different than pure female sexual behavior. Basically, the distinction would be that male sexual behavior is more closely associated with these aggressive instincts and strict genital pleasure. And women's sexuality is more associated with what she calls epimyalectic behaviors, which has to do with nurturing, childbirth kinds of things. So, on the one hand, you see the misunderstanding in male-female sexuality would be that the female wants the male to be more epimyalectic in his behavior, and the man wants the woman to be more epideictic in her behavior.
I don't think we should mix anymore.
And there's those problems or confusions in intimacy or in intimate relationships between men and women. So the problem, you see, as it comes down to, is that we have trouble socializing males into sexuality because nobody talks about it. And so where do males learn this from? And so that's why I wanted you to read this one, because it's kind of funny. Bill Cosby has a routine about how you can never let on you don't know anything about, you know, it. which is true. I mean, men don't talk to one another in an intimate way about sexuality, unless maybe, like he says, they've had a number of beers or whatever, to say that they don't know or whatever. And I think this is an interesting paragraph here. He says, there was a woman I knew... No. Where is that? Wait, no, it's down after having had a few beers. Most of what we know is learned through experiences with women cross-checked against what we've read or heard from men, but in that order. For what it's worth, a woman I know who grew up in Germany says Italian men really are the best lovers because they don't mind talking with each other about how to please a woman. From my experience, American men don't talk about that a lot. Or if they do, it's based on myth and misunderstandings, especially stemming from this epidiectic problem.
When they talk about pleasing women, is it physical stimulation, or are they talking about what in terms of meaning, nurturing, and affection kind of things, too?
All
that
of those.
Kind of stuff. Okay.
I would imagine. I also put this on the right-hand side of this page. I clipped this article out of the same magazine. This came from Ms. Magazine, and it was an issue devoted to males and male intimacy and male sexuality. And one of the interesting articles was to do with men and their fathers. One of the problems about the Industrial Revolution was that it took the male out of the household. And the male culture became separated from the family and from, of course, young males that are growing up within the home. So, in other words, another source of what it meant to be male and how males approach and understand life and the basic identity component of masculinity was lost. And so a lot of people would say that males have trouble finding this now. And they look to various sources for it. And one of the main problems is that it's a alienation from one's father. And of course there's a lot of fathers that are absent from homes anyway because of the fact that homes break up and there's divorces. Robert Bly, maybe some of you have read his recent writings or heard him speak about male sexuality. And Robert Bly is a poet. I think he's from Minnesota, or at least he's from the Midwest someplace. And his biography and his change in his poetry in the last 20, 30 years pretty much go along with changes in the male psyche in our society over that same period of time. In that Bly's poetry started looking at how, at this ecological relationship between humans and nature. And he started writing and setting American Indians, especially around Minnesota, and how they were in communion with nature and how they felt a part of their natural surroundings. And they revered nature, and it sort of gets tied up in the word the ecology movement. And so his poetry changed too along those lines. Then more recently, this would also mean incorporating one's feminine side in one's maleness. And more recently, he's pointed out that over the last 30 years, we've seen men go through different stages in understanding what it means to be masculine. He calls the 50s stage, where men had a pretty good vision of the male, but it was, you know, really distorted because there was no feminine components at all. Men probably didn't even see women in the 50s. You know, they were just invisible. You know, they're in terms of communication or understanding what women were about. The idea that men should be providers, should be responsible, hardworking, that they should not cry or show the female emotions in an outward way. And he considers Ronald Reagan to probably be one of the best examples of this kind of a male, this 50s male. That there's a callousness that's involved, too, toward anybody that's weak, can't take care of themselves. Brutality toward the poor, the elderly, and so on. And then the Vietnam War, he would consider to be an outgrowth of this image. And then after Vietnam, men started really questioning who and what they were and the kind of violent, aggressive elements that are involved in masculinity. But who did they start looking toward for a new image? They started looking toward women. And they started looking toward the women's movement. And they started all of a sudden seeing women and what they were about. And then they realize that they had this absent side of them, this thing that they hadn't dealt with in the past, the feminine side. And so in the 60s and 70s, men started cultivating this side of themselves. But where Bly is now is to point out that that's not the answer either. You'll never discover, for a man, you'll never discover the masculine side by investigating the feminine side. In other words, what men still have to do is that task of finding out what men essentially are and what makes them different and what is down there. Well, I wanted to leave you with a myth and about male sexuality and pick it up next time, and I want you to think about the various elements. It's a story, it takes place in chivalrous times in that stage of mythology or legend. And it's a story about a king who had a castle far off in some land. And they had been having trouble recently because the hunters would go out into the forest, in a certain place in the forest, and they would disappear. They wouldn't come back. And so people were kind of worried about this and didn't really know what to make of it. Well, one day, this knight comes to the court, and he's alone, and he says that he's bored, there's nothing to do, and is there anything that he can do for the kingdom? And so the king tells him what's been going on. And so he says, well, I'll go out and see what I can do about it. So he goes out alone, and he just has his dog with him, and he's walking through the forest in this particular area, and he's crossing this pond, this kind of marshy pond, and all of a sudden something reaches out and grabs the dog and takes it down. And so he realizes that something's in that pond, and so he goes home, or he goes back to the castle, and he gets some other men, and they get some buckets to start bucketing out the pond to see what's down there. And they bucket out, and finally they get all the water out, and they look at the bottom, and here's this hairy figure with hair up and down his body, kind of a rust-colored, ugly thing. And they realize that this is, whatever it is the thing that's been causing the problem. And so they take it back to the courtyard. They put it in a cage, and they leave it there in the courtyard. And people talk about it and walk by and look at it. And one day, the king's 8-year-old son is out playing in the courtyard. He's got this golden ball that he plays with, and it rolls into the cage. And so he wants to get it back, so he asks the monster for his ball back. And the monster says, so this is interesting, it's always a deal, it's never a yes or no answer. But, says, okay, I'll give you your ball back if you let me out of the cage. And so the little boy, he's really scared about that. So he says, no, I can't do that. And so he comes back the next day and he asks the monster again. And the monster says, no, not until you let me out of the cage. So the boy comes back the next day and he says, look, I can't let you out of the cage because I don't have the key. And he says, well, the monster says, well, where is the key? And he says, it's under my mother's pillow. So the boy realizes, and the monster realizes, that somehow the boy just can't go up and ask his mother for the key, because she'd say no, or she'd say, go out and get a job, something like that. So he has to wait till his parents are away, and he decides to do this. And so he goes up and he takes the key out of from under the pillow, and he lets the monster out of the cage, and he gets his ball back, and so the monster starts to take off, and the little boy says, hey, wait a minute, you can't take off, because they'll know that I let you out of the cage then. And, and so what am I going to do? And so the monster says, well, I don't want to stay around here. I guess you're going to have to come with me. So he puts the boy on his shoulders, and they take off into the forest. And that's the end of the story. Now, Robert Bly uses this story to give an illustration of the problem about male and male identity in modern society. Yeah. What is the cult of phallus? Anybody recall that? How many people read the article? I can just pick on that. Do you remember, Greg, what the cult of fell on?
Yes, it's a religious or cultural focusing on the penis, and it carries a lot of cultural traditions.
Okay, what kind of traditions? Or what hangs on to that? I mean, you know, what is hung on that cult? Or that understanding, and it's a worship in a way, but also rituals that involve depictions of the male penis, a phallic symbol, or such like. What is it used for? What kinds of things?
Protection.
Okay, protection. People put it, you know, by their vineyards or their orchards or on the city limit sign to scare away people, or to, you know, somehow bring powers to be that will protect. What else did you say?
Or not just protect, but also, it's weird, not nurture, but give strength. I can't think what word I'm trying to get at here.
Okay. Yeah, energizing or something like that too. Okay, and the males, as she points out, tend to be a lot more interested in their genitalia than women do, or than women are. Not only that, but than women are interested in their own genitalia. Kinsey and other. This has been corroborated by other researchers too, have discovered that men can get sexually excited from their own genitalia, and that women don't tend to think about men's genitalia as a source of so much excitement. And this then gets at what she says is a major mix-up in modern civilization among men, in that they mix up what she calls epidiectic displays and epigamic displays or behaviors. The cult of phallus is for men. It's between men. The rituals that are involved in tribal societies involve men alone in these rituals. They're part of male culture. Probably one translation in modern culture would be the locker room.
The what?
The male locker room, in a, like in a gymnasium, or, you know, whatever, where men get together, they tell sex jokes and make comments about the size and so on of penises, things like that. It's tied up with status seeking, appeasement. This is in primitive tribal cultures and also among the higher apes. I don't know if anybody ever saw it. We were talking the other day at lunch about this new movie by Kurosawa called Ron, R-A-N. He had another movie too recently called Kagamusha. I don't know if anybody saw that, but there was one incredible scene where this warlord is sitting on this hill overlooking the battle, and he sits on this stool and he has his legs, you know, spread wide apart, you know, and watching this battle. And to us it seems like a really funny pose, because you don't usually see men sitting like that. But apes, the higher apes do, like baboons and so on, they use that as an intimidation. They spread their legs, and it's meant to, as a sign to other males, to stay away, or you know, to try to intimidate them. Or if they're among baboon groups, if they're feeding, they post males on the perimeter of the group who sit there with their legs spread as a means of probably protection and scaring away. But the important thing in epidiectic displays to remember is that they're meant for other men. They're not meant for women. Epigamic displays, then, are the kinds of behaviors that have to do with courtship or mating, where are rituals that are associated with that. And those, if they come from males, are meant for females. And they're meant to entice and to attract females. Yes, Greg.
In the article, she tried to correlate the behavior of baboons and primates, some primates, with that defense mechanism, the phallus cult. And then she goes right into talking about modern society. And do you think she correlates? Does she think that baboons and gorillas, this is a self-reflective action? Or is this an impulse? Is this something that they do intentionally? Or is it an innate response?
Right in from baboon behavior to adult modern society.
Okay,
reflective, you know.
Well, what she's saying is that is that there's a continuity, what she's looking for is a continuity between animal behavior and human behavior, but she's not saying that humans can't intervene. The presence of culture means that by and large probably the majority of human behavior is not instinctive, mm-hmm. because culture has intervened. But what she's saying is that there's a threshold of meaning there, and then we can also point to genes and hormonal changes and differences too between men and women. But that doesn't mean that we can't intervene at some other point with culture.
I felt, maybe it was just a male slant, but I felt that she was doing an anthropological background to the phallus cult, and the thread is very thin between coming from a primate to a human being.
She also quotes Irving Goffman there, who says that maybe a lot of this behavior is not because we have similar biology to the apes, but because humans are copying animals, what they see animals do. I think that is really part of it too. I remember Bill Cosby routine where he was talking about this milkman who would have this horse that would come down his street, and he would stand there looking at this horse, and he couldn't believe how the horse could wiggle, you know, parts of its skin to get the flies off. And so he thought that was really cool, so he went out in his backyard and he took off all his clothes and he got down on his hands and knees and he was trying to see if he could do it. And right then his father comes walking out. Son, you know, the baby kid, you know. But I think, you know, there's how much of our facial expressions are not, you know, kind of biologically determined, but maybe we copy other animals, or people that live close to animals may do that. So there's both sides of it. But the cult of phallus, there's a movie about an Australian Aboriginal group that my school has. It's really interesting in this regard because it is a ritual that surrounding the phallus, and they have this long, you know, think about 10 feet long and with feathers on it and all that, and they strap it around themselves and they dance around with it, and it has to do with bringing well-being and fertility and so on to the community. Totem poles, signify how powerful the tribal leader is in that village where it's posted.
I was just interested in stuff at this point. When I read the article, they mentioned New Guinea there and three or four tribes in New Guinea. Have you had any personal experience with this in New Guinea when you were there?
The only thing that's been coming to my mind, I was not in an area where those tribes are a very different area, but I was thinking immediately how in the dramatizations that the children do, like you have a school program or a special function or end of the year, and it can even be, you know, whether you know, as you turn dramatizations or great dramatizing, and how this can be second, third, fourth grade boys. They will use coconut, for instance, as the genitals, and it's just full of all kinds of sexual suggestiveness and so on. And the little kind of boys, the whole families and so on. And maybe that's why they're from here. And that carries over to the adults, too, that I'm just emphasizing that already in the young boys, this is very much a part of their...
No. Nothing with the young girls in then?
I think right offhand, I think I would say no. Why not? At least it was like so much more obvious with the woman that I was didn't become aware that it was.
Was this a ritual or was it a game?
Just a dramatization, you know, make up a play.
I don't want to, you know, concentrate on stuff in that article too much because it's available for you to read if you're interested in it. Her point about bringing up this distinction between the epidiactic and epidemic displays is that it's that distinction she feels has fallen out in Western culture and modern American culture. And she would say other Western European cultures too. So that what men think is impressive to women in an epigamic sense is probably what they think is, or what they feel is impressive to other men or to themselves. And she, this is really cute, this survey or the poll conducted by the Village Voice, and she asked, they asked men and women, first they asked men what they imagined women admired the most in men or about men, and then they asked women what they actually did, you know, think about what they really did admire. Well, the men come out thinking that women like, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger look, you know, who he is. Mm-hmm. Most men thought muscular chest and shoulders.
Can you explain that for us?
Arnold Schwarzenegger is Mr. World, you know, muscles, you know, huge bodybuilder, right, you know, real muscular. Muscular chest and shoulders, 21% of the men thought that's what women most admired. And the four things that turned out to be pretty near the top were muscular chest and shoulders, muscular arms, large penis, and tallness.
Talking about physical stuff now, right?
Yeah.
They asked it specifically.
Just physical stuff.
Just physical, okay.
Now, what women really admire was not so dispersed. Women were much more in agreement. What do you think it was?
That's what I would say. Yeah.
Huh. I wonder if they didn't give them that choice.
Well, when I read my husband, I wasn't sure if my would have been in there or not.
Well, they said 40% of the women, 40% of the women answered that.
We don't want to prejudice the opinions. Let's find out this group thinks first.
I've read the article. I know the answer.
Well, you know, whether this is true or not is one issue. The fact is that I think her point is well taken, that there's a disagreement among men and women about it.
And what was the women?
40% of the women said buttocks, described as small and sexy.
Okay.
Okay, so...
What was
Well, that was the no, but that was, you know, the 15% said slimness, 13% flat stomach, 11% said eyes.
Yeah,
1% said muscular chest and shoulders. 2% said large penis. Now, see, I don't even know anything about the survey. Maybe there was 20 people. You know, who knows? How we're at.
Balls,
buttocks. Balls, head, and symbol.
Let's take our own survey.
I'm biased now. Balls, buttocks.
Oh, God. Okay, and then she gets some other evidence, too, about how ancient cultures recognized that there should be a distinction, a dichotomy between aggression and violence and sexual behavior toward women by males. But the two get mixed up in the brain of men in modern culture. And she points out, and I've done some reading in this area too, for example, ancient Indian India and ancient China, Japan, and so on, these ancient cultures, Greek cultures, made very clear distinctions that aggression was one thing and violence, and sexual behavior toward women was another. In one of the books of the Kama Sutra, it points out what they, the Kama Sutra assumed that men initiate women into sexuality, genital sexuality, because most of the marriages take place, or did take place, between older, more experienced men and younger virgins. And so it was the male's responsibility to instruct and educate the woman into pleasurable sexuality. And
Pleasurable
was
in there? Was that part of it? Yeah, why? I mean, that doesn't seem consistent, the idea of it being pleasurable.
You know, well, the thing is that it's a man's responsibility to teach the woman sexual pleasure.
Teach her how to give him sexual pleasure.
No.
No? This is what part
the
of
prescription
your...
would be okay, that on the wedding night, there's talk that takes place in a tea ceremony, and then the second night, you know, so on. And finally, it isn't until the ninth night that any genital contact takes place.
Oh.
I think you know, that's a good point, is that they probably hadn't had any contact prior to that time.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, me too. I'm surprised at that.
The Valley of the Horses, did you know?
I haven't read that.
What's
that?
I had that book in the car yet.
One of the
Gino played the can of camp, plant of the cave bear, the second in that series.
Rape is, of course, actually pretty rare in most cultures, and is associated with things like property and war, especially in the exchange of property that takes place in war. The Old Testament is filled with several examples like that. Incidentally, there's a primary example of epideictic behavior in the book of Genesis. This is quoted quite often, Genesis 24:2, which deals with Abraham's requirement that people that made oaths to him put their hands on his testicles to make the oath, rather than the Bible. Because I guess the Bible didn't exist in those days.
Abraham?
Yeah.
Wasn't it true that the first rape laws in the book were actually property crimes?
Sure.
Yeah.
And there's that, you know, in terms of how much of rape is, in modern culture, is a case of epideictic display. Now, it may be for the rape to take place, the man has to fantasize that the woman is a willing partner. And a lot of men do that. There's a scene in the movie, if you've ever seen the movie, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where Robert Redford's visiting his girlfriend, who's the teacher in the community, and he sneaks in her bedroom and he draws her his gun, you know, and he says, okay, take off your clothes. Mm-hmm. And you don't know that they even, at this point in the movie, you don't know that they know one another. So you think it actually is, you know, kind of like an impending rape. And then when she starts to take off her clothes and then they embrace and she says, you know, like, where have you been? Why didn't you get here sooner? And the impression is that, you know, all you have to do is show your gun and, you know, the woman will melt. And there are, you know, rapists that do say that, you know, that they thought, you know, they go get a gun and they go out and they confront a woman with a gun and they think that she's just going to... you know, melt in their arms, so to speak. And obviously, it's a pure objectification and carrying out of a fantasy that woman is the extension of the male's subjective side, even though she has real flesh and blood.
What were you saying about rape being rare?
Yeah, I was going to ask you too, isn't that as far as we might interpret it in our society, because worldwide, the rape, it might be very common.
Yeah, that's right, I think. You know, I hesitate to say that rape is rare in one culture than the next.
And you said except for, also, you were discounting the property of water, so...
Yeah, but I was going to say, I don't think I ever got around to it, that there's a lot of rape in modern society that may be the idea of one man getting back at another man. I think a lot of interracial rape is this way too, by black males against white females, like taking something that belongs to the white man, something that shouldn't be theirs or that isn't theirs. Rape is closely associated with social class, to use a bad concept, but socioeconomic status might be another one.
If you're poor, you get raped.
Yeah.
Or you rape?
Well, both, because most of it is intra-class. In other words, poor people rape poor people, and you know, white people rape white people, and those kinds of things.
How does that fit?
Interracial rape is actually, I think, about 6 or 7% of rapes.
How does that get back at your previous statement about that it may be one man getting back at another? You would think that would lead to the poor man getting back at the rich.
No, I didn't mean to classify all those like that. But I'm saying, especially what I said was interracial rape might be an example of that. But most rape is not like that. But it gets at another important point, and who is it going to read the article or listen to the tape by Ray McKeever? Did you get to listen to it? One of the things that he points out in there, in that tape, he gives three reasons why men oppress women that have to do with the relationships between men and women in society. And one of them is that he doesn't really get into very much, because I think most other people have written about this particular aspect, and that's as a means of impressing other men. In other words, as a way of showing other men that one has power and influence, that they can control the behavior or be active sexually with many women.
Do you correspond that with sexual assault?
Yeah, to some extent, yeah.
Well, or I didn't think he was making that connection at all.
Oh, no. Well, okay, go ahead.
I thought it was just something that, you know, he alluded to the... to the fact that I can, I'm dating this many people and so on and so forth. And I didn't think it was he wasn't asserting power just with sexual performance, but with sexual socialization.
Yeah.
How many women that you can go out with and date, and this fellow wasn't very up to date with it because he can't.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that was entirely that, but you see how that gets into being able to testify about, to use that word again, but in fact that's where the word testify comes from, that Abraham passage about testicles. the fact that a lot of men lie about their sex lives to one another, you know, because they want to appear, you know, more powerful and have more status in the eyes of others. That's part of that epidiectic display.